I'm here with Simone Haysom, a researcher with the Humanitarian Policy Group and co-author of Sanctuary in the City, Urban Displacement and Vulnerability in the Gaza Strip, a look at internal displacement over the past 10 years. Simone, this research in Gaza is part of a larger research project on urban displacement. Can you explain why HBG undertook this research in Gaza and how the findings compared to other contexts?
As in many places, displaced residents in Gaza in urban areas do not have pronounced vulnerabilities, which are absent amongst people who have not been displaced. Poor quality services or poor access to services affect whole neighborhoods or whole towns. All of the threats to life and livelihood that displaced Palestinians in Gaza face are shared with their neighbors, are shared with those who have not lost their homes. Nevertheless, it was evident that in some cases, displacement compounded existing vulnerabilities or heightened the risks that families faced. It was also clear that support of family and community and assistance from local and international organizations mitigated the effects of displacement. As in other contexts, such as Kabul, Nairobi, and Ye, which we've also studied as part of this series, this really highlights the value of community-based approaches rather than delivering assistance on the basis of status. Luckily, in general, this is something that the humanitarian community in Gaza understands.
Given the rate of displacement, urbanization, and general issues of overcrowding and burdened services in Gaza, what are your expectations about the living conditions in Gaza in the future?
Well, a common theme in our interviews with Palestinians in the course of this study was the desire for self-sufficiency. Yet reports from the UN and other sources foretell a very different story. Many commentators agree that Gaza has been de-developing for years, and with the blockade, this process has really accelerated. What this means is that the population is, through years of unemployment and highly constrained opportunities for training and education outside the Gaza Strip, becoming less skilled and poorer. Public services such as education, health and water and sanitation are deteriorating. At the same time, the population is still growing with almost no possibility for out-migration and severe constraints imposed by the blockade and other Israeli policies on the development of infrastructure and housing. The UN has questioned whether Gaza will be livable to describe the conditions these terms imply for Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip in 2020. Displacement is one factor contributing to the housing backlog, both because of the destructions of homes, that's the original cause of displacement, but also because displaced families enter the rental market or enter already overcrowded homes of relatives. And while displacement compounds the difficulties of dealing with overcrowding and the housing shortage, in turn, growing poverty and overcrowding diminishes the population's ability to host and support the displaced, and growing need in the population decreases the funding that organizations have for programs like rental assistance. And like this, the effects of the conflict have a chronic and cumulative effect on living conditions for Palestinians in Gaza.
So in your report, you quote a humanitarian aid worker saying that programming in Gaza has been based on what is possible, not what is needed. What are the kind of challenges that make it difficult to design programs that meet needs?
It's worth mentioning that that quote came from someone working from a US-funded NGO. And he was talking about multiple constraints, but primarily the combination of the blockade and no-contact policies imposed by some donors who have listed Hamas as a terrorist organization and otherwise seek to isolate them politically. Policies that seek to limit interaction with high-level Hamas political figures are often softly enforced, but for the nationals of many countries, potential liability exists in providing material and other support to terrorist groups. Donors have different positions on what might confer benefit or legitimacy, which means that agencies are constrained more by their sourcing of funding and the nationality of their staff than by the actual content of their activities. Humanitarian actors tend to downplay the actual effects of these policies, and most maintain that the blockade is the largest impediment to their operations in Gaza. And it has really had a huge effect, especially when considering reconstruction projects. Yet no-contact policies are having an effect on assistance too. For example, many agencies are barred from purchasing goods on the open market, as Hamas's control of smuggling tunnels allows it to levy a tax on most consumer goods in Gaza. They also impose a significant financial and bureaucratic burden, the policies that is, that make it more difficult to hand over projects to government departments, and they hamper coordination. Agencies reported being threatened with prosecution of individual staff if programs such as providing school windows went ahead, and some have to undertake onerous, convoluted, and expensive procedures to procure basic office equipment without falling afoul of clauses in U.S. funding contracts.
So it's mentioned in your reports that people in Gaza are becoming more aid-reliant. Was this evident in your fieldwork?
Yes, I think what is interesting is that people often talked about wanting assistance, but assistance which would help them to be more self-sufficient. People wanted job creation, opportunities for training and education, opportunities to invest in their enterprises or to access the labor markets they once had. It's quite easy to look at Gaza now and imagine it as if it had always been so poor, but many of the families which now get food aid did not used to a few years ago. They had family members working in Israel or made a living in the private sector in Gaza, which has been devastated in recent years. It was striking, in fact, how even displaced people ranked livelihoods as more important than reconstruction housing.
So what are your key recommendations?
It may have little traction given that there's no meaningful ongoing peace process, but it is nonetheless important to reiterate that truly addressing the challenges facing Palestinians in Gaza requires lifting the blockade and a political solution to the long-running conflict over self-determination in the region. More immediately, we had a number of recommendations, but I'll highlight just three now. Firstly, we recommended that both Hamas and the Palestinian Authority should establish a legal and administrative framework for displacement, for example, along the lines of the guiding principles for internal displacement. This would be binding for the authorities concerned and also guide the responses of other national and international actors. Secondly, and related to this, donors should reevaluate the relevance of limiting interaction with Hamas, as isolation policies appeared to be having a counterproductive impact on prospects for promoting governance in the interests of the population and of promoting sound development planning. Lastly, UN agencies, international NGOs, and national NGOs, as well as representatives of displaced Palestinians, should engage in a discussion about how durable solutions for displacement in Gaza should be assessed, especially for those who've been displaced from the access-restricted area.
So that was Simone Haysom of the Humanitarian Policy Group. For more information on urban displacement in Gaza, visit www.odi.org.uk/hpg.